Welcome to the Accessibility Online webinar series, a collaborative between the U.S. Access Board and the ADA National Network. At this time, I'm going to turn over the microphone to Peggy Greenwell with the U.S. Access Board, who will start our session today. Peggy, go
Conference
ahead.
Conference recording started.
Thank you, Robin, and welcome everyone to our session today on emergency transportable housing. Our presenter today is Marcia Maz. And Marcia, if you don't know her, has joined the Access Board in 1989. So I'll do the math for you. That means she's been here about 25 years. And until September of 2010, she held the position of the Technical Assistance Coordinator, but she is now holds the position of the Director of the Office of Technical and Information Services. She's also the Access Board's representative to the Model Code Organization and is a member of the ICC ANSI A117 Committee on Architectural Features and Design of Public Buildings and Residential Structures for Persons with Disabilities and the National Fire Protection Association, or NFPA, Disability Access Review Advisory Committee. She is the recipient of the prestigious Ronald H. Brown Standards Leadership Award that was presented at the 2010 U.S. Celebration of World Standards Day. So I think you're in good hands here. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Marcia.
Thank you, Peggy.
All the way up.
Thank you, Peggy. I hope you can hear me now. I appreciate the introduction, and as Peggy noted, we're here today to talk about emergency transportable housing. Slide 12 shows what today's agenda is. We have an overview of the rule and some of the issues addressed and an opportunity for questions and answers. This is a fairly brief rulemaking, and we may potentially have some time for questions outside the scope of this presentation at the end. So we will go forward to slide 13. This final rule for emergency transportable housing was published in the Federal Register in May of 2014. It has an effective date, June 6, 2014, and there were some corrections. These were format corrections for the amendatory language published in the Federal Register in September of 2014. This was simply a procedural and didn't affect the content of the final rule at all. People often get confused about what an effective date means, particularly in the Access Board's guidelines. As I think most of you know, the Access Board's guidelines are not automatically enforceable. They are adopted by other enforcing agencies and then made enforceable. Under the Architectural Barriers Act, the Department of Housing and Community Development must adopt our guidelines to make them enforceable for housing facilities that are not on military bases. And so we are awaiting HUD, Housing and Urban Development, to adopt these rules under the Barriers Act for them to be effective for FEMA. So at this point in time, FEMA is still subject to the older Architectural Barriers Act standard, which is the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards. We hope that HUD will update its Barriers Act standards soon so that FEMA can go forward and use these new guidelines as Barriers Act standards. At the moment, we're not aware of any state or local governments that provide emergency transportable housing directly to recipients, and therefore we're not aware of any housing that would be covered under the ADA once the Department of Justice adopts these guidelines and makes them enforceable under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But just to summarize, these guidelines are not yet enforceable under either the ADA or the Barriers Act, but we hope that that will change shortly. Next slide, please. Okay. We started this rulemaking by convening an advisory committee, and it really was a very diverse group. The advisory committee was comprised of organizations representing people with disabilities and as well as manufacturers of emergency transportable housing and also standard setting organizations involved in the issuance of private sector standards covering emergency transportable housing and units used for other purposes other than emergencies. And it was a really active group that did look at a lot of issues related to emergency housing. As you probably are aware, our interest in emergency transportable housing developed as a result of the Katrina events surrounding Katrina. And I think most of you are probably aware that there were a number of lawsuits against FEMA because units were not made accessible during Katrina. I think that the landscape has changed considerably since then. Most of you who are interested in emergency response know that FEMA has made very, very significant strides in improving its response to people with disabilities, and we have worked very, very closely with them on a number of issues, particularly related to emergency transportable housing. Slide 16. So this rulemaking addressed a bunch of different issues. The first and most difficult issue that we had to tackle is exactly what are we talking about. We had to develop a definition for emergency transportable housing that was sufficiently limited in scope that it covered only those things for which we had some concern and didn't inadvertently net up other types of dwelling units for which we didn't feel changes to the accessibility guidelines were warranted. Another big area of concern was scoping. How would we rescope the requirements so that a fair and equitable approach was taken to providing emergency transportable housing, particularly on sites developed by the government to respond to large-scale events? There are a number of other issues that we addressed along the way: operable parts, site constraints, adaptability, work surfaces, carpet, bedrooms, alarms, and weather radios. This is just a sort of a broad overview of the topics that we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes. Slide 17. So on this slide, you'll see our new definition of emergency transportable housing. And the key elements to this definition are that this is a prefabricated, factory-built structure. And secondly, that it's transportable by a single transport vehicle. Manufactured housing, which is primarily used to provide emergency transportable housing, can be transported on multiple vehicles and cobbled together in the field, and you can have a very, very large unit as a result. But this rulemaking was to address the typical types of emergency housing provided in response to an event that is transported on just one vehicle and as a consequence is extremely small and limited in size. Other restrictions on emergency transportable housing impact the ability to provide access into these units. For example, most local jurisdictions require that emergency transportable housing be kept up on its wheels and not taken off its wheels and put on another structure. And because of this, we have some issues related to ramp lengths and rise of the entrance. And so, again, it's very important to limit this definition to those units that come on one truck, not multiple trucks, because once you have multiple trucks, you're typically installing the unit into a foundation, and all of the constraints that previously existed for emergency transportable housing no longer exist. And although theoretically these emergency transportable housing units can include travel trailers, park models, these are not being used currently by the federal government. Travel trailers and park models are typically smaller units than manufactured housing units, and FEMA policy now uses only manufactured housing units. And for the purposes of our document and our discussion today, these units are considered residential dwelling units as opposed to transient lodging in our guidelines. Slide 18. As I said, one of our big issues that we had to tackle was scoping. As you know, we've coined a term, sort of a phrase, units with mobility features, that is in our 2004 ADA and ABA accessibility guidelines and in the 2010 ADA standards, units with mobility features. That's to describe those units accessible to people with mobility disabilities. So when units with mobility features are located on private sites that are provided by the occupant, we are requiring here that the number of such units that must be accessible will be determined by a needs assessment that's conducted by the agency providing the units. And again, that's typically FEMA. Similarly, with units with communication features, the units will be provided as determined by a needs assessment conducted by FEMA. So we have taken away the 5% minimum requirement that you would find in UFAS for dwelling units and replaced it with a individually tailored response. Each person who applies for emergency housing has got to respond to a lot of questions about their needs and their qualifications for such units. So typically, FEMA has the information necessary to determine whether or not the applicant needs a unit that contains mobility features or communication features. And we did not feel that it would make a lot of sense to provide a mobility unit in the driveway of a person who did not have a need for the accessibility features in that particular mobility unit. These sites, again, are provided by the occupant, so it's usually that person's driveway or their backyard, or it could potentially be a campsite that they own that is some distance from their destroyed home. Next slide, please. Group sites are those that are developed by the provider of the units, and you see an image here of all these trailers lined up in a very large site that was probably formerly Farmer Brown's field, and we saw a lot of these in the media after Katrina in particular, Katrina and Rita. For group sites, we have required 10% of the unit pads to be designed to accept units that include mobility features. In addition to that, 5% of the units actually provided must provide mobility features. So consistent with UFAS, you will have 5% of the units that are accessible at the outset. The accessible units will be brought onto the site and installed in the site. In addition, 10% of unit pads that potentially are occupied by inaccessible units are capable of receiving an accessible unit at a later time as people begin to be returned to their homes and new people on the waiting list potentially come in, they will have different needs. And so the 10% unit pads is designed to allow the providing agency to swap out an inaccessible unit for an accessible unit should the need arise. Slide 20. Another type of site that FEMA typically uses are commercial sites. And these commercial sites are leased by FEMA, but they already exist. And you see these often in vacation areas where people will rent a unit, and we try not to call them trailers, but I always do want to say trailer. They look like trailers, but they're not all trailers. And so these sites are already set up. Their infrastructure is already there. The streets are already there. In many cases, the units themselves are already in place. And in good times, people will come and rent one of these units, or they'll bring their own unit and install it in a already prepared site ready to accept that unit with the hookups for the electrical and plumbing, et cetera. And these commercial sites don't lend themselves to a great deal of alteration. And so here what the rule says is that the accessible units will be provided as determined by a needs assessment conducted by the entity providing the units. This is to allow the providing entity to elect to put people who need accessible units wherever it is most appropriate for the program itself. If, for example, a particular private leased site doesn't lend itself to accessibility, it allows FEMA the flexibility to go ahead and lease that site if they need it, and to provide accessible units in another site that better lends itself to accessibility. But once they've determined that someone has a need for an accessible unit and they assign them to this site, then in fact they must provide them an accessible unit. In addition, they're going to have to ensure that all the common areas are accessible. And that is where we run into some difficulties, because on many of these private sites, you find that common areas and such as mail rooms, and some of them have swimming pools, laundry facilities, other types of facilities are not accessible, and the owner is not at all amenable to having the agency come in and make changes to the site. They're simply willing to lease it in times of an emergency. Slide 21. So again, scoping is we've addressed scoping, and the understanding you should have here is that there's a mixture of scoping in response to a needs assessment and scoping for these large sites that the agency will go out and develop on its own. Once we decide that someone is eligible for an accessible unit and is entitled to an accessible unit, that unit has to meet all the requirements of the standard. Certain sites present some real barriers to meeting those requirements. And with respect to ramps, and I alluded earlier to the fact that oftentimes the local jurisdictions that are allowing these units to be installed don't want to see them come down off their wheels because they can't be quickly removed if, for example, another event is going to happen, or if the jurisdiction feels that they're no longer serving their purpose. So as you will see in the two images that I have here on the page, these units are up on their wheels, and that gives you a significant rise to overcome just to get into the unit. So we have new exceptions for ramp run and ramp rise only applicable where site constraints prohibit a complying ramp. And if you look at the image on the left-hand side of the page, you see a unit that almost entirely obstructs the dwelling unit behind it. It's actually placed in someone's front yard, and that is not atypical. And you can see how narrow that site is with two adjacent properties on each side, of the dwelling unit that has the emergency transportable housing unit in its front yard. So the exceptions will allow a ramp slope up to 1 in 10 maximum, and also allow a 36 as opposed to 30 inch rise. And the reason for the 36 inches is to minimize the necessity for an intermediate ramp landing. And most of these trailers are 36 inches in height with their wheels on. So this is just acknowledging the reality of the rise here with the 1 in 10 slope max. The administering agency, such as FEMA, completely understand, however, that if someone is unable to use that 1 in 10 slope with a 36-inch rise, that other types of accommodations will have to be provided. But this provision is really aimed at making it possible for people with disabilities who want that unit right in front of their house because they want to be able to supervise the reconstruction of their homes, or in fact, in some cases, want to be able to protect their homes after an emergency, aren't told by the agency, sorry, we'd love to put a unit in your front yard just like we've done for everybody else on the block, but we can't do it because the unit can't comply with the accessibility standards, and we've ascertained that you need an accessible unit. And this did occur quite often in the past. So now this allows flexibility for the agency to work with the occupant of the unit and determine whether the occupant of the unit in fact can and wants a slightly steeper, higher ramp for their unit, as opposed to being told that they have to go and occupy a unit in a group site away from their home, which also separates them often from their support networks. On the right-hand side of the page, you see an example of a site which is also, again, in someone's yard, but it appears to have lots of space available and would not be eligible for this exception, even if the owner said, sure, I can, or if the occupant said, sure, I can do a steeper ramp. FEMA would not be permitted to build a steeper ramp because there are no site constraints prohibiting compliance. Slide 22. Platform lifts. After talking about site constraints, I think perhaps a lot of you were thinking, well, why don't we just put in a platform lift? After all, a platform lift doesn't take up much space. These guidelines prohibit the use of platform lifts at the primary entrance to the unit. And there's solid reasoning behind this. The primary entrance to an emergency transportable housing unit is the only entrance that is fully accessible. there are escape windows, there are other ways to escape from a unit, but the only truly accessible entrance is the primary entrance to the unit. In areas that have been affected by particularly a weather event or a fire event or some other disaster, the power sources are often unstable. There was a great concern here that the time that it would take to recall a lift to the entrance was precious time that the occupant needed to get out of the unit. Unfortunately, these types of units are again, very small, very condensed spaces, and they don't take very long to become engulfed by fire or for other things to threaten life. And so we want people to be able to get out of these units as quickly as possible. And platform lifts really don't serve that purpose. So they are prohibited at the primary entrance. If a unit happens to have a secondary entrance, such as, and many do, another door, then a platform lift can, in fact, be installed at that secondary entrance, but not at the primary unit entrance. Slide 23. I should mention to the listeners that exception numbers are on each of these, or that the provision numbers are on each of these slides, and so I've not taken our time out of our time here to tell you what the section numbers are. You can certainly review that by going back through the webinar. Kitchen outlets. As most of you who are familiar with the ADA standards know, there are exceptions for kitchen outlets that have to be within so many inches of a corner in particular. And that is a requirement of the electrical code, not a accessibility requirement. And when things are tucked into a corner, they really, really can't be accessible if you have to reach over an obstruction such as a countertop. So for all other types of units, there are exceptions for some of the over-counter kitchen outlets to be within reach ranges. But this document removes the exceptions for kitchen outlets and acknowledges that there are exceptions in the National Electrical Code that do allow for face-mounted outlets. You see some here right in the image. And so the thought here is that people really do people have very limited countertop space in emergency transportable housing units. Again, these are very tiny kitchens. And so you really do need access to the outlets in order to run whatever kitchen appliances you happen to have. And unlike a larger kitchen where you may have other options to plug in your appliances in other places, you don't have those options in emergency transportable housing. Slide 24. Operable parts. The advisory committee looked at issues related to operable parts in emergency transportable housing units. And their attention was drawn to this primarily because there are certain shutoffs and other controls that are actually located beneath the unit body, and you have to crawl in underneath the unit in order to throw the master switch for some of the systems within the unit. And there was a concern that these would be required to be accessible, and that would not be possible and would require even more elevation of the unit than is currently the case. So the advisory committee recommended exempting any operable parts that are located beneath the unit body. But then they also began to look at things like water shutoff valves. And I think we all are familiar with these. There's an image here of a water shutoff that is tucked in a corner below the toilet seat, for example. And the committee literally reading the existing guidelines says, well, these are operable parts, and all operable parts on accessible things have to be accessible themselves. And obviously, there's no place for a clear floor space, and these are lower than the low limits of reach ranges, and they cannot really reasonably be made accessible. Although they did explore the option of requiring one master water shutoff valve for the entire unit. And in fact, we did propose that. But as we looked at this requirement, we came to the conclusion that this is an issue not just for emergency transportable housing. This is an issue for all types of dwelling units. And so the guidelines are exempting water shutoff valves for all types of units, regardless of whether they are emergency transportable housing or not. A master shutoff is less feasible, and the cost associated with a master shutoff really was a serious concern if we were to try and impose that on all types of units, such as multi-story, multi-housing facilities. So we took the opportunity through this rulemaking to exempt water shutoff valves for all types of dwelling units. Slide 25. The committee, advisory committee, looked at the issue of adaptable features, which are currently permitted in the 2010 ADA standards for residential dwelling units, and acknowledging that these units are supposed to be put in place and ready for use without any unnecessary delays. The committee felt, and the board concurred, that adaptability was not a desirable outcome, particularly when adaptability means that certain necessary features, such as grab bars, would be provided at a later date or upon request. And so the advisory committee recommended that all of the flexibility in UFAS for adaptable features be removed, and we certainly have done that. We want these units to have their grab bars, have all of the necessary features, so that an occupant who's already had significant stress in their life is able to move in and start using the unit right away, and not having to wait for an administering agency or other agency to come along and install their grab bars. Next slide. Not just grab bars, but also things like the seats and showers. As many of you probably know, the current ADA standards only require seats in transfer showers where provided, and in roll-in showers in transient lodging units. Again, the advisory committee and the board felt that it was necessary to have shower seats. People who have survived a natural disaster or some other event are not going to be arriving at emergency transportable housing units with their shower chairs. And so, again, the committee felt strongly that every shower provided should have a seat. Slide 21. Oh, sorry, 27. here we show you an image of grab bars, and this is just an image of a very pretty accessible toilet room that I wanted to share with folks. But it shows here an accessible toilet with its associated grab bars. Again, the grab bars would be required in showers and in bathtubs as well, unlike residential dwelling units, other types of residential dwelling units. Slide 28. Lavatories and sinks would have a knee clearance required under the current standards for other types of residential dwelling units. You can have temporary obstructions of the knee and toe clearance with removable base cabinets. And it was felt that these removable base cabinets would simply wind up in a landfill somewhere near the group site, and it didn't make sense to again put in place a provision that would require the housing provider to come out again and take away the obstruction and in order to afford people accessibility. We wanted that accessibility right at the outset. The water spray unit in the kitchen is a new feature, one that is required not just for the convenience of people who find it easier to rinse their dishes and do their dishes in the kitchen, but also because oftentimes in an emergency, people who typically have other types of support, may have personal assistance and other folks assisting them, won't have the type of assistance often, or the assistance will be less reliable. And so the water spray unit was seen by the advisory committee as a feature that would be necessary for people who are having to do things for themselves that they wouldn't normally have to do in a non-emergency situation. Slide 29. Kitchen work surfaces. As some of you probably know, when FEMA provides emergency transportable housing units, they come completely furnished. And so this is quite different from what happens when a state or local government provides housing for folks. Typically, you bring your own furniture with you. Well, you don't do that for emergency transportable housing units. Again, we said that these kitchens are usually quite small, and so what this provision does is it allows that the kitchen table that is supplied with the unit to substitute for that required work surface, which is accessible work surface, which is required in all other types of units. There are some pretty good reasons for this. If we have a kitchen work surface in this very tiny kitchen, then we are going to lose base cabinetry. And emergency transportable housing units already have very little storage. And so folks who occupy these units find that it's very difficult to occupy these units and find places to put all their stuff if we take away their cabinets. So what this does is it allows an accessible table to be substituted for the required work surface, provided that there's an electrical outlet within reach of that accessible table. And you can see in the image provided here that there's an outlet on the leg of the table. And that would easily satisfy that. It could also be that the table is provided next to a wall and there's a wall outlet there. But in this case, it's provided right on the leg of the table. The outlet has to be within reach. And another provision, another condition is that all of the countertops in the kitchen are no higher than 34 inches. As you may know, in other types of residential dwelling units, only the supplied work surface and the kitchen sink, for example, would be at 34 inches. Other countertops are typically at the 36-inch height. Slide 30. These guidelines also prohibit the use of carpets in emergency transportable housing units. Carpet is difficult to clean, particularly if you don't have a vacuum cleaner, if all you have is a broom or some other means to sweep away debris. And so the advisory committee recommended that carpet not be permitted. Other reasons for prohibiting carpet is that new carpet, of course, off gases, and there was some concern for that. In reality, all FEMA units have been provided without carpet for some time. Slide 31. Currently, in the 2010 ADA standards, there is a requirement for clearance alongside beds in transient lodging, but there's no similar requirement in residential dwelling units because residential dwelling units typically are not supplied with furniture. So it's a non-issue where you're bringing your own furniture. You get to lay it out, and you get to decide what kinds of spaces you need alongside the bed. But in an emergency transportable housing unit where they're providing the bed, they're providing the cabinetry, they're providing everything, the advisory committee and the board concurred that the requirement that is similar to the one for transient lodging is critical. And there is a difference here, though. There's a requirement only for a clearance along one side of the bed. Again, these are very small units. The bedrooms are very small, and requiring a clearance on both sides of a single bed would result in a much larger bedroom, taking away from living space and other spaces within the unit. So the compromise here is to require clearance only along one side of a bed. Slide 32. Another new requirement is clearance around furniture that is supplied to the bedroom. If the bedroom is less than 70 square feet, 70 square feet is the minimum size of bedrooms allowed by most building codes. So that's your smallest bedroom allowed in the building code, and not atypical to find a 70 square foot bedroom in emergency transportable housing. And if they choose to provide a bedroom that small, they're going to have to ensure that a person using a wheelchair can negotiate that room, get around the bed to any operable parts, get to cabinets and storage, closets. So again, we're requiring the provider of the unit to think through how the unit is going to be used by someone using a wheelchair or other mobility device, and to ensure that the furniture placement allows for that person to really have a usable bedroom. Slide 33. Bedroom lighting controls are covered. There is a requirement here for the lighting control for the bedroom lighting to be reachable from the bed. Now, that can be satisfied using remote controls or other types of devices. As I've said too many times already, these are very small spaces. The supplied furniture rarely includes things like floor lamps next to the bed or even a bedside table on which someone could put a lamp. And the concern here was that people are occupying unfamiliar spaces, and if they need to get in and out of bed in the middle of the night, they're going to need to be able to turn on the lights, and they are not in a position to be able to accommodate that themselves as they would be in typical residential dwelling units by bringing in a floor lamp or putting a desk lamp on the bedside table. So, again, a requirement for bedroom lighting controls to be reachable from the bed. Slide 34. Visible smoke alarms. There is a requirement here that addresses visible alarms and also stresses that these alarms have to have a reliable power source. Where this is usually taken care of in the built environment through the building code, in these emergency transportable housing units, we felt the need to be very explicit that the power source had to be very reliable. So you have requirements in section 809 to have a backup power to this visible alarm, because in fact a visible alarm without backup power will flash for a very short time before the batteries are exhausted. And in areas where emergencies and natural disasters have occurred, again, power sources are unreliable. So you can't depend on the power provided to the unit, the typical power provided to the unit. It may go out. So you're going to have a good battery backup for these visible alarms, and you're going to have other sources of power to power them up when necessary. And this is already done by FEMA. As we were developing these guidelines, FEMA was right alongside of us, and each issue that we raised, particularly in the area of life and fire safety, were issues that FEMA was extremely responsive to and incorporated into their standard specifications. In fact, you'll find a visible smoke alarm in each and every FEMA unit. Slide 35. Whether alert systems are provided in FEMA units. They're not necessarily going to be provided in units provided by others, but FEMA does provide them. And FEMA does provide a weather alert system that has accessible operable parts and has a dual system for providing both visible and audible announcements. And this is a new requirement to the standards, but one that FEMA has been satisfying for some time. Next slide. Questions. We're ready for questions, and I hope that I haven't bored you so much that you are asleep and unable to ask them.
Okay, thanks, Marcia, and we'll give you a couple minutes to catch your breath here. We have had some questions come in, and we'll take the opportunity to respond them, but please feel free to submit additional questions at this point. So let me start out with some more general questions. And the first one is just about this whole area of emergency transportable housing. We've heard that access in these units has improved since Katrina. Can you give us sort of an update on how things are? You know, what kind of availability are manufacturers changing the design of the units that they had originally, or the way they had originally been designing the units?
I think it's fair to say that these units are compliant with these proposed with these guidelines, even though they are not currently mandatory due to HUD's not having adopted them under the Architectural Barriers Act. But FEMA in particular and all of DHS has been very responsive since Katrina and Rita in terms of improving their emergency transportable housing stock. They have involved the board in several of their reviews of units. They've actually invited us to go on site where the units are being constructed, and we have checked them for accessibility numerous times. So I think it's fair to say that the FEMA network is far more responsive, and in fact is a model at this point in time in terms of how they respond to people with disabilities. We can direct you to Marcy Roth at FEMA, who directs their accessibility or the disability unit, and I think they have regional coordinators who are involved with accessibility and have developed a complete network that didn't exist prior to Sandy.
Okay.
I'm sorry, didn't exist prior to Katrina.
Right.
Did exist at the time Sandy struck.
Right. Okay, have some other questions. I'll lump these two together. What's considered within the reach for electrical outlets, and do remote controls have to comply with all operable part requirements?
What's considered within reach in terms of outlets? Outlets have to be within the reach ranges specified in the standards. There's no changes to the reach ranges in the standards. This is the same as for everything else. So you have that 15 to 48 inch reach range, 15 inches, no lower than 15 inches, no higher than 48 inches. In some cases, if you're reaching over obstructions, for example, the reach range drops down to 46 inches, and the reach depth is controlled. But it doesn't differ for emergency transportable housing units from anything else. Remote controls would have to also be accessible. And so I happen to have, and in fact the image that I showed was a remote control for the fans and light in my own bedroom, and that remote control has a holder that can be installed on the wall. And if it were installed on the wall in that holder, that holder would have to be within reach range.
Okay. Could you be more explicit about what would qualify as a reliable backup power for visible smoke alarms?
Sure. You would have to have a commercial light and power source. You would have to have a battery backup, and we do have specifications in the standards for them. I don't remember them right off the top of my head, but there is a section number listed on that slide that tells you exactly where to look. And so, again, you would have to have that reliable emergency backup power. Otherwise, it would not be compliant.
Yeah, and I'm just looking over that slide, and it's section 809.3.1.2. That's where you would get further guidance on that question. Okay, are there any clear floor space requirements for emergency transportable housing units?
Are there any
clear floor space requirements?
All of the requirements that would apply to residential dwelling units apply to emergency transportable housing units, except where we have discussed certain deviations in this presentation. So we have not modified the clear floor space requirements for residential dwelling units So they would still exist. Maneuvering clearance at doors is still a requirement. Clear floor space is still a requirement. Nothing changes except those things that we've listed in this presentation. Otherwise, it is a residential dwelling unit. That's why we were careful to define it as a residential dwelling unit to ensure that all of the provisions for residential dwelling units would apply.
Okay. In your slide, you discuss operating parts exempted, such as shutoff valves, etc. We assume that all other controls, door hardware, heating and cooling, etc., must meet existing requirements. Is this correct?
That is correct.
Many of these units have ceiling air conditioners. We assume alternative controls at an accessible location would be required. Would remote control suffice versus direct access to the control? What about the accessibility of remote control, which you did talk about already a little bit?
We have been vague about the requirement for how to make the lighting, the bedroom lighting, accessible or within reach of the bed. And we were deliberately vague because we believed that the only way to achieve this easily would be either by ensuring that the on-off switch was located right at the head of the bed within reach of someone lying down, or a remote control be provided. In general, I don't accept the notion of remote controls as directly satisfying the requirements of the ADA standards. Because we were vague in this one, we just simply said a means for controlling the light within reach, you know, from the bed. So that means could in fact be a remote control. But I think in general, if you want to use equipment that is not part of the building, then you're going to have to rely on equivalent facilitation to do that. Whether it's a portable ramp or it's a remote control for your lavatory or anything else if it's personal equipment, if it's not attached to the building, generally it doesn't satisfy the building requirements. In the case of that one provision, I believe a remote control does, since we simply said a means, provide a means.
Okay, yeah, they were asking specifically about ceiling air conditioners.
And air conditioners.
Ceiling air conditioners,
yeah.
Where you'd have an operating mechanism.
Right. So typically you have a thermostat on the wall.
Right.
And if you have a thermostat on the wall, I think the thermostat has to be within reach. You can't put it out of the reach of people with disabilities in an accessible unit and hand them a remote control, unless you want to invoke equivalent facilitation. And I think we all understand the risk of invoking equivalent facilitation.
Okay. Is there a time frame associated with this type of housing? For example, we understand that some people in New Orleans are still living in their emergency transportable housing provided after Katrina because their homes have not been rebuilt. That brings up the issue of whether or not these types of housing units can actually become long-term, which has different issues in terms of accessibility and exemptions.
Good question, and I can't agree more that there is at least the appearance that some of these units do become long-term. In fact, that's one of the concerns a lot of local jurisdictions have, and one of the reasons that they don't want to see these things come down off their wheels. They want them to be temporary housing and not permanent housing. And it's our understanding that the FEMA regulations do govern how long these units can be in place. And I, off the top of my head, don't remember the time frame. But if the questioner wants to email me, maz@access-board.gov, I'll be more than happy to look that up for them and get back to them. But that's wholly under FEMA's control when it comes to emergency housing provided by the federal government.
Okay. Getting back to space requirements, this person said residential guidelines require turning clearance in all rooms connected by an accessible route. Is turning clearance required in all rooms, even rooms that are 70 square feet?
Yes, it is. All of the requirements applicable to other types of residential dwelling units apply to these units unless I've addressed them here, an exception here. So these are residential dwelling units and turning space is required. And I don't know how you would accommodate turning space in a 70 square foot room unless you were to put only a twin bed in there. And then that would be tough, but I think you could do it.
Okay. Is parking a part of the requirements for this type of housing? For example, typically the trailers are parked in a linear fashion with vehicle parking at the side and or front of the trailer. Is accessible parking and path of travel or other than ramped entrance addressed, or does it refer to other parts of the standard?
Other parts of the standards applicable to residential dwelling units are still applicable here. If parking is provided, the parking has to be accessible. And our newer guidelines and the 2010 ADA standards do address situations where there's one parking space per unit. And so if, for example, in your example, you said that each unit has its own parking space, and that parking space would any parking space associated with an accessible unit has got to be accessible. And in addition, you have to be able to get from your accessible unit, your accessible parking, to the boundary of the site. You have to be able to get to public transportation stops. You have to be able to get to common areas provided on site, such as the laundry room. Some of them even have post offices or mail drops areas. You would have to be able to get to any common area that serves the unit.
Okay. Well, at this point, we're looking for questions. So please feel free to submit your question. As Marcia mentioned earlier, we're willing to accept questions on other topics, given that we have some time left over here. So I'll give you a chance to submit those in the chat room, and we'll take a little bit of a break here.
Well, then we shut it down. Shut it down.
Okay. Some brave soul has submitted a question here. Bleachers. Does ADA address the hand railing often put in front of stadium seating?
Repeat the question.
Does ADA address the hand railing often put in front of stadium seating? 42 inches okay, or is 28 inches preferred?
I think you're talking about guardrails.
I think the caller is talking about guardrails that sometimes, particularly in the past, would obstruct the sight lines of someone seated in a wheelchair space. ADA doesn't expressly or directly address guardrails. However, equivalent sight lines are required. So if other people have sight lines over the guardrails, then people seated in the accessible seating also have to have sight lines over the guardrails. But the provision of a guardrail, the height of a guardrail, is a building code issue and not an accessibility issue.
Okay. May a common area office break room with a loose microwave on the counter use the exception for parallel approach at 606.2 exception 1, or does the microwave need to be fixed?
If you look at the Department of Justice 2010 ADA standards, one of the first provisions you will see in those standards states that these standards apply only to the built environment. So in my opinion, the Department of Justice added language that restricts the standards to essentially to the built environment. Those things that don't fall out when the building is turned upside down, I think that the standards themselves cannot address furnishings that are put into the kitchen. So in my view, it would have to be built in, a microwave built in. That doesn't mean that the Department of Justice regulations that go beyond the standards wouldn't also demand accessibility to furniture. And in fact, folks interested in that topic should read the preamble to the Department of Justice Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Equipment and Furniture to understand the Department of Justice's view on how ADA requirements might apply to furnishings.
Okay. Someone's mentioning they may have missed this. They apologize. Most of the conversation references FEMA. How are local emergency agencies who provide transportable housing covered?
We're not aware of local, state or local government agencies that provide emergency transportable housing. Again, these are relocatable buildings. They're not permanent housing. We're not talking here about the church basement, which might be provided by a voluntary organization, or housing that might be provided by a state or local government that isn't transported in on a single vehicle and installed on site. We are not currently aware of any state or local government programs that do this because, quite frankly, this expense is typically absorbed by the federal government in a declared emergency. Not being aware of any, I can't give you an example of one that exists. But if a state or local government were to opt to provide emergency transportable housing in an emergency, then it would be covered by these requirements once they are adopted by the Department of Justice under the Americans with Disabilities Act. As I mentioned earlier, these updates to our guidelines have not been adopted either under the ADA or under the Architectural Barriers Act. Once they are adopted, a state or local government program would be covered if one exists.
Okay. Well, what's the definition of primary entrance?
We have not defined the term primary entrance. We believe that that is something that is pretty intuitive and obvious. Most of these units do not have but one door. And most people don't go in and out of their units through windows. So usually it's the front door It's the door that people are going to be entering in and out of in most cases. Some units do have a back door. Typically, that back door does not even have a stair built to it. It's just a means of escape, and you open that back door, fling it open, and you can leap out the back door down 36 inches. Typically, you won't find any kind of structure built up to that secondary door. So usually, the primary entrance in emergency transportable housing is the only entrance.
When do you anticipate HUD adopting these guidelines?
I have to tell everybody that Peggy got a little smile when she said that. I would like to be able to report that HUD is about to adopt these or has adopted these, but in fact, HUD has yet to adopt our 2004 guidelines to replace UFAS under the Architectural Barriers Act. And so I'm at a loss. I don't have an answer to that.
Okay. Section 804.2 discusses pass-through kitchens and U-shaped kitchens. What about kitchens that do not comply with the ADAG definition of pass-through or U-shaped, i.e. a kitchen with an island in the middle, a kitchen with three entrances? What are the requirements for these kitchens?
It's true that the guidelines don't address kitchens with islands, and the ANSI, ANSI, A117 committee, in fact, has looked at this issue, and I think that the ultimate outcome was that the ANSI committee was willing to regard a large residential kitchen with a big island in the middle where you go in and you can make a complete turn around that island and come back out a large opening, but you may be coming out the same opening you went in on technically as a pass-through kitchen. But I'm not positive, and nothing that the ANSI committee has done is finalized yet. So it is a matter that is being discussed by ANSI A117. There was a proposal off the top of my head. I don't remember exactly how that proposal has been dealt with. You can go to www.iccsafe.org and pull up the current draft of the ANSI A117 standard to see how ANSI is dealing with this. It's quite likely that once ANSI has finished dealing with this, that we would be comfortable with a similar interpretation in our guidelines, but I can't really speak to that at this point in time, since the ANSI isn't done and we have not gone back through and compared everything that's been changed in ANSI to what exists in our guidelines. But we will do that once the next edition of the A117 is out, and we will determine whether or not some corresponding changes need to be made in our guidelines.
Okay. This is clearly outside of the jurisdiction of the board, but this person just wanted to know, they assume that the rules for service animals remain the same for emergency transportable housing as for non-emergency housing. Do you have any insight on that?
I cannot imagine how they would be different or what justification there would be for them to be different. But if you're talking about emergency transportable housing that is currently being provided by FEMA, FEMA would be the agency to ask about that, as well as the Department of Justice in their coordination and review role under Section 504.
Okay, just encouraging people again to, we're making our way through all your questions here, so please feel free to submit a couple more if you have some. This person wrote that the sections that we refer to, 809, 2.2.5.1 on through 809.1.1.2 that are shown on the slides are referred to which set of regulations? They don't seem to be part of the 2010 ADA standard.
Exactly right. They are not part of the 2010 ADA standards because Department of Justice has not yet adopted these requirements. And also, I'll note that we did a significant amount of reorganizing of sections in order to embed the emergency transportable housing criteria in our guidelines. These changes are in our guidelines. If you go to the Access Board's website, www.access-board.gov, and you go to our accessibility guidelines as opposed to the standards. And they're a little bit tough to get to, and that is deliberate because we don't typically want people accidentally going, thinking that the guidelines are the enforceable document as opposed to the adopted standards. But they are there on our website under guidelines and standards. And if you drill down on our guidelines and standards site in the background under ADA standards, and you sort of have to, the way I do it is just sort of back into them, and you will find our guidelines there. And our version of the ADA and ABA accessibility guidelines has integrated all of the changes made as a result of the emergency transportable housing rulemaking. The rulemaking itself is a real bear to read because it was done in a mandatory language. Amend this section by deleting and insert, that kind of language. And so it's very, very hard to read on its face. Anyone wanting to get more information about the emergency transportable housing guideline should read the preamble to our final rule and then have open the latest version of our guidelines to track over to the corresponding section numbers. But that person is right, and I'm glad they raised the question. I should have mentioned it myself, that the section numbers are different, and Chapter 8 has been reorganized to accommodate the insertion of the emergency transportable housing requirements, as has Section 233.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. Are all breakers in an electrical breaker panel required to be within reach range?
Yes. If that panel box is provided within the dwelling unit, they're operable parts and they need to be accessible. And there is no conflict with electrical code in making them accessible.
Okay. If the wheels are removed and the unit is placed on steel pedestals or other support systems, are they still considered transportable housing and such that are subject to the accessibility regulations?
I don't know about steel pedestals, but typically the units are supported once they're brought onto the site, but the wheels are still not removed. There is a supporting structure that is put underneath them in order to maintain stability and all of that. And they are emergency transportable housing units, and according to our definition, transportable in one peace in response to an emergency. If it's not in response to an emergency, if you just go out and buy yourself a manufactured housing unit and you put it somewhere, for your, maybe it's your, you know, your fishing camp, it's not an emergency transportable housing unit, even though it may be a relative of the very same units that are used for emergency transporting full housing.
Okay, there's someone here that was hopeful that we could provide a link to the proposed standards for equipment and furnishings, and we're not able to do that, obviously, while we're doing this webinar, but it is a Department of Justice rule. So advance notice of proposed rulemaking, correct, but it is a Department of Justice. So without giving you a link at this point, if you go on their website, ADA.gov, you should be able to find that rule, that advance notice. Keep looking through here. We have can you elaborate, Marcia, on what was meant if a user cannot use a 1 in 10 ramp, they can be accommodated for the 1 in 12?
Those comments were in relation to the exceptions that we had for ramp, slope, and rise for emergency transportable housing units. And I think, as I said before, in the past, agencies would go to install a unit in someone's yard, for example, or in their driveway, and find that they had insufficient space on the site in which to install a compliant ramp. As a result, the agency would have to say to that occupant, "We're sorry, we can't accommodate you in your with a trailer or a unit in your driveway like your neighbors. We have to send you off to a group site or make other arrangements for you somewhere else, because we're prohibited from putting a non-compliant unit out and calling it an accessible unit." Oftentimes what happened was that the occupant of the unit would say, "But wait a minute, I have a motorized chair. I can do a steeper ramp." And still the agencies felt prohibited from installing that unit in their yard because it was non-compliant and that person was entitled to an accessible unit. And so these exceptions allow for a slightly steeper ramp with a longer run where we feel that slight increased steepness with a longer run is not doesn't create a potential hazard, in that FEMA is responsible for ensuring that the occupant can use it. And the occupant is going to be the one saying, "Yes, I'd rather have a steeper ramp with a longer run than be assigned to a unit somewhere away from my home." These are really tough choices that people are having to make, and we want to leave the power in the hands of the occupant, the person with a disability, to decide if they want to accept a compromise in accessibility rather than be accommodated somewhere other than at their home. So, again, the occupant would be advised that this ramp is going to be steeper than the standards would normally permit, and FEMA would undertake to ask the occupant if that is acceptable to them.
Okay, and this is just a follow-up on the person that was interested in that advance notice. I guess they misunderstood and thought maybe it was available for comment. And you're correct, it is not available for comment at this point. But if you have any questions about the status of it, you should contact the Department of Justice directly. And if you don't know their number, it's 800-514-0301. There was another question I can respond to here about accessible route connecting elements in a park. Let me get back to it directly. For example, is pavement required in connecting parking to a sports field, for example? No, pavement is not required. What is required is that the surface be firm, stable, and slip resistant. So in this environment, you could choose to use concrete or asphalt, but you could also use some sort of soil stabilizer. You could use a matting, geoform, some crusher fines. There's other solutions and surfaces that could be provided that could be stable and firm. And so that is what your requirement is for when connecting those elements in that setting. And that goes for any outdoor setting where you have accessible route requirements connecting elements on a site, and could very well be part of this rulemaking where you're connecting elements where you have a group site, for example. Marcia mentioned the common areas. You have the requirement to connect elements on a site, so that would still apply. We probably have time for maybe one more here, and let me see if I can find one. Perhaps not, but I think this is a good time to remind people, if you don't know already, about how you can get additional technical assistance from the board. We have a technical assistance hotline that you can reach at 800-872-2253. That's the voice number, or 800-993-2822. That's TTY. You can also email us at TA, short for technical assistance, at access-board.gov. Or you can always look at our website, access-board.gov, and be informed of any new rulemaking or projects that we're involved in. These webinars, if this is your first one, are offered on the first Thursday of each month, and the schedule is posted on the Accessibility Online website. And we thank you for your participation today. And at this point, I want to remind you of the next session, which is on January 8th. And that will be on accessible hospitals and medical care facilities, and that's going to be an advanced session. So we've been doing a series of advanced sessions. Basically, these are areas that we have already done a basic session on, hospitals and medical care facilities. So now we want to have a more advanced level discussion and have give you an opportunity to ask some additional questions about those particular facilities. So feel free to sign up for that webinar. It's, again, January 8th from 2:30 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Robin.
Thank you very much, Peggy and Marcia, for a great session. Lots of questions and discussion on a variety of different issues today. This concludes our session. You may disconnect from the session at this time by either closing out your browser and